always ask that kind of a question the instant I step on the soil of a new state. And there's no such thing as an instant political expert. It takes years of writing for newspapers to become that.
Senator, how do you think the ticket is doing in Florida?
I think that's the same question in a different form. Well, let me put it this way. With time as short as it is, it's rather obvious that the Vice President and I want to spend that time where it has the best promise of success, and the Florida Democratic leaders obviously felt that our efforts could be productive here. I hope their assessment was right. We're going to do our best to see that it's right.
How would you rate the campaign at this point in the state between your own ticket and the opposition?
Well, on this question, I'm not an instant success as an expert. I have no opinion on it. I hope to get one before I'm through today.
Senator Muskie?
Yes.
What can President Johnson do to help the ticket?
Well, we have the basic problem that you people in the press and news media understand at least as well as we do, establishing our own identities, especially the separate identity of Mr. Humphrey and myself. So this is a campaign in which we're undertaking to emphasize what we represent and what we stand for. And Mr. Johnson, obviously, is associated with a great record of achievement legislative field on domestic problems. We're proud of that record, and in any way that that record can be advanced, presented, discussed, that would be helpful. On the question of Vietnam, this is where the question of separate identity is all important, and we're trying to establish it.
Would you want him campaigning for you in Maine?
This is a judgment for him to make.
Senator Muskie, one of the real sources of concern in this campaign have been the hecklers. Current issue of a national news magazine says that the best man, to quote them, they say by all odds, the most successful anti-heckler has been Edmund Muskie. What has been your formula for turning off these hecklers?
Well, I don't think there's any guaranteed formula. My approach to it has been twofold. One, I assume that most of the young people are concerned, and honestly concerned, young people about the difficult issues which confront us at home and abroad. I think also they're frustrated by the belief, whether it's fair or unfair, accurate or inaccurate, that the government today is an establishment which they can't easily enter, which does not respond to their concern or their ideas. And I think this is why so many of them take the role of protest, and even noisy protest at times. Well, with respect to young people like this, I think the answer is try to establish lines of communication with them, talk to them, and get them to believe that the system is open to them, even though it doesn't produce instantly the results that they might like, and that many of us, indeed I think most of us in public life, want them involved and appreciate their involvement, not only to support us, especially, but because of the contribution they can make to our system. And so, in every way that I can, as I've gone along and been confronted by these young people, I've tried to make it clear to them that I am willing to listen to them and that I hope they will listen to me. Now, this works with some of them, it doesn't work with others. Yesterday in Syracuse, at Syracuse University, we had a turnout of, I think, 7,500 to 8,000 young students, most of whom came to hear and wanted to listen. There was a very small group of very noisy hecklers led by an alleged vice presidential candidate, Judith Magee, who used a bullhorn to constantly disrupt. Now, her intentions and purposes were obviously different than those I just described. She was there to disrupt the effort of another vice presidential candidate to speak, the young students who had invited him to come. And with her, she simply doesn't understand the courtesies that candidates ought to try to extend to each other in a campaign, and she was a different kind of heckler. But most of the students who came wanted to listen. She unfortunately interrupted the time I had available for them to ask questions, and we didn't get all the questions that we would have liked. But this wasn't the fault of the students. This was the fault of Miss Major, who presumes to speak here this summer.
Senator, has either you or Mr. Humphrey been informed by either Senator McCarthy or someone who worked with him that a series of four pledges is required to fix the four buildings for us? I know you said no on Sunday, but I wonder if that still holds.
Well, I spoke to the Vice President again late Sunday night. I haven't had a chance to speak to him since. As of then, he had not been contacted, and as of now, I have not.
Senator, Mr. Humphrey has made several statements lately that bring into question how far he would take his administration into certain areas, like increasing Social Security by 50%, greatly increasing federal aid to education, and getting an income for everybody, whether they worked or not. Do you stand with him four square on all these issues?
I think in the field of Social Security, he's set up a target that is humane and I think realistic in terms of the needs of our older people. With respect to education, obviously, we've got to expand our effort here over the years. I don't think he set a timetable or an amount. He indicated the goal that I think we ought to move toward, as this is, education is the great single answer to the unrest in our society, the great single answer to creating opportunity for people by enabling them to develop their own skills and their own potential and take advantage of the opportunities which are available in a private enterprise society. Education from the beginning of our country has been a keystone to an enlightened society able to govern itself. I don't think he's taken a position, a final position on the idea of a guaranteed national income, and neither have I.
Senator, do you think that the cost of lives to get jobs is
my judgment, the cost of lives in any war, the lives lost in any war, are worth more than the cost for which the war was fought. But we don't always have a choice. I don't think the lives lost in World War II were worth the war. You know, in World War I, but sometimes the other side, those who undertake to challenge you, to challenge values that you hold dear, give you no choice. They have to lose lives in their defense.
Do you think the negotiations are worth it?
Well, what are the alternatives to negotiations? The alternatives to negotiations are, one, the military escalation, which means more lives, or a unilateral withdrawal, which isn't supported by any candidate for the presidency this year. So you are advocating? Well, I think regular consultation is or can be productive, that we should be receptive to the idea of summit conferences as long as they appear to serve our mutual interests. So long as the preparations are adequate for fruitful discussions, and so long as whether or not we agree on means, we share objectives. And if that can be done on an annual basis, it could be fruitful. Of course, if the Soviet Union should take the position that it would use such conferences only for propaganda purposes, we might take another look at it. But I think our experience in the past 7 or 8 years suggests that there are areas of mutual interest which we can discuss. The nuclear test ban treaty, the Antarctic treaty, the consular treaty, the treaty arranging commercial air transport between our countries. There are areas, not in which we undertake to do favors for the other, but in which our mutual interests coincide to the point where we can work out agreements. And I think that's a worthwhile exercise and a means of gradually, in an evolutionary way, reducing tensions between our two countries. I think that's what the Vice President had in mind.
Senator, there are some who say that Mr. Humphrey's recent television speech on Vietnam may have damaged the negotiations in Paris in terms of foreclosing some alternative buyer negotiators there? Would you comment?
Well, I think that this whole business of free debate in our society, to which we're all committed, certainly to which the press is committed, gives the other side comfort from time to time. The fact that Senate committees can hold hearings in which they're sharply critical of administration policy certainly must give some comfort to the other side. This is the price you pay for debate. The Vice President told me at the very outset that we should do nothing or say nothing to jeopardize the negotiations in Paris, and that's been our unswerving objective. But at the same time, he's being constantly pressed by the American electorate, by the press, to give some clue as to what his approach to the problem of Vietnam would be if and when he's elected president. Well, he can't do that without, in a sense, creating some risk, I suppose, that the objective I just described might be infringed upon. That certainly is not his intention, and I think it was his intention, and I think he succeeded. Certainly in the judgment of Abel Harriman and Mr. Vance, who are our negotiators, he succeeded in spelling out the general direction of his views on the subject without undermining the negotiations. We can never know what the impact is on the other side any more than we can know whether the other side is even committed to the idea of a negotiated settlement in its own interest. We don't know that as yet. Communist negotiators always conceal their real purposes, the real impact upon them of anything we say in this country. But the only way to avoid saying anything that would conceivably damage negotiations would be for all Americans to declare a moratorium on discussing Vietnam. I don't know if anybody would suggest that.
Well, sir, when you say that the other side might take some comfort in debate, are you suggesting that the other side might have found some comfort in any of Mr. Humphrey's remarks?
They might find comfort in anybody's. Why should I limit myself to Mr. Humphrey? They might have found some comfort in Mr. Nixon's remarks or Mr. Agnew's, or even General LeMay's. I don't know how they could. It's conceivable. Or any senator. Senators are constantly talking about Vietnam. There was a story yesterday that 23 senators said they would support the idea of an unconditional bombing halt. Now, just how are you going to cut a senator off from comment? This debate is going on constantly, and you're focusing on one man out of 200 million and asking whether the other side gets comfort out of his comments. Well, we get comfort out of in a lot of ways out of the things a lot of people say. But that's the price of free debate. And Mr. Humphrey has been very careful to try to draw the line between the objective of safeguarding the negotiations so that we may have maximum opportunities of ending the war before January 20th, and at the same time spelling out the general thrust of his attitude in Vietnam. Both are obligations. At least a great number of the American people feel he has an obligation to do the second as well as to do the first.
Senators?
Yes.
Senator Muskie, we are preparing to send three men into orbit on the Apollo 7 mission from Cape Kennedy Friday. James Webb has quit as head of the space agency, saying that we are cutting back too drastically in the space race. How do you assess the importance of spending versus cutting back in our U.S. space program?
Well, it's a question of priorities. There are a number of Americans in many fields who are saying either that we're not spending enough or that we're spending too much. Whether you're talking about education, or cleaning up our polluted air and water, or health, or housing, or creating job opportunities, or outer space, or military. I don't care what field of domestic spending you talk about. There are people today who are ready to say that we're doing either too much or too little. So it's a question of assigning priorities, obviously, in the space effort. We could justify, in terms of the objectives that we'd like to achieve at some point, greater spending. You could justify greater spending in some of these other fields. Now, the Congress, under the pressure of a majority in the Congress, cut back spending by $6 billion. Now, there may be some variation in this figure because of individual modifications of that general order, which the Congress has approved from time to time. But when you cut back $6 billion in non-military spending, something's got to give. And there's been an effort to spread it across the board in ways that probably no individual senator, for example, would approve 100%, every one of us, could justify a different order of priorities. But this is the net result of a Congress which has been under pressure from the country to reduce spending. This is one of the results of that effort.
Senator, would you care to comment about the possibility of this election going into the House?
Well, I don't really have an informed judgment on that. I gather from the Wallace threat that this is probably a real possibility for the first time in my lifetime. But you'd have to actually sit down state by state and analyze the net effect of the third-party movement in each, and then add up the electoral votes to determine whether or not either candidate, either of the two principal candidates, can hope to get a majority. And I think it's a little premature to make that judgment because I think the picture is changing with respect to the two major candidates.
Senator, the polls we've seen on a national level look pretty bleak for the Democrat Party right now. The polls we've seen on a local level look even worse, with possibly the Democrat Party running in third place. Could you respond to this?
Well, I can't comment on your local polls because I haven't seen them. Do I know why? When the surveys upon which they were based was taken, who took them. With respect to the national polls, we don't have a national poll which represents public opinion more recent than 2 weeks ago, or now it would be 17 or 18 days. A lot has happened in the last 17 or 18 days. So I think a poll that reflects opinion that far back gives us no real clues as to what is happening today. And that's what I'm interested in, because obviously, if you start from behind, you're interested in trends more than the situation in any given day. We hope that the trend is upward and that it will cross the victory line on November 5th. That's our objective, and if the trend is that moving that way, it's of interest to us. I think it might be appropriate to point out two or three things. One, that Mr. Nixon, who seems to be taking victory for granted, is opposed by 57% to 61% of Americans by his most favorable polls. I would not consider myself in a comfortable position if I were taking election for granted in the light of that fact. Secondly, in 1948, between October 1st and November 5th, Mr. Truman picked up 11 to 12 points and Mr. Dewey dropped 5 for a net gain of 16 in the time frame that we're talking about in this election. Even in 1964, Mr. Goldwater, between October 1st and November 5th, picked up 12 points. So that this is still a horse race, and my very much a horse race. And my impression is, and again, those who travel with me know that I don't make guesses about the future. My impression is that there's a notable buoyancy to our campaign in the last 2 weeks that has grown. We're off the ground, whether or not we get into orbit is something yet to be determined. We're going to certainly work in that direction. We think the possibilities are there if everything falls in place as we hope it will.
Senator Muskie?
Senator Muskie?
Yes.
Many Polish Americans are very proud of your candidacy. Is there anything the administration can do to help these East European nations?
Well, I think the administration has tried. Are you suggesting that we ought to give them a handout here in order to get the Polish-American vote? No, I don't think anything of that kind should be done. We've tried in various ways over the past 8 years to indicate our sympathy for the people behind the Iron Curtain who would like to be free without stimulating them to the kind of thing that happened in Hungary in 1956, an unjustified reliance upon a promise of liberation from the administration then in power. I think that's irresponsible. But we've tried to step up our trade with these East European countries and to help them in any way that we could, short of an irresponsible promise, short of apathy or indifference to what happens there. It's a delicate line to walk. We tried to do it, and so did President Eisenhower, for that matter. I think that since World War II, we've tried to walk that line, indicate complete sympathy for them, and willingness to do anything concrete that would not have the opposite effect to that which we want. And That's, I think, all we can do. And, of course, in the case of the Czechoslovakian crisis, we tried, did our best, and I think succeeded to a great extent, to mobilize the world expression of outrage of what happened. Well, that appears to have inhibited the Russians for a short time. But apparently they're gradually easing into just as tough restrictions on the Czechs as they intended initially, without the bloodbath that all of us feared might have taken place.
The Romanians indicate they intend to fight if the same thing happens to them. Can we help them if they fight?
Now, that's the kind of a question you should be asked and shouldn't be answered.
Senator, what about Cuba and that same decision? How would you say the American policy right now is? How would you say it could be changed?
Well, I'm no expert on the Cuban situation. I share the sympathy of all Americans for the desire of those Cubans who want to be free, to achieve freedom, and to achieve a government that's truly representative and responsive to them and their needs. The history of the last 8 years indicates the difficulty of doing that. And I have no formula today which I can throw out that has an answer to that problem.
Senator, what priority would a Humphrey Muskie administration put, if any, on balancing the budget?
Well, you know, we're going to achieve a balance, I think, the Treasury people tell me, in the next calendar year, if the present trends continue. This is the result of surtax, which this administration proposed, and which this Congress, the Democratic Congress, enacted, and also the spending cuts that were put into effect this year. Now, always against the desirability of a balanced budget, you have these urgent problems, some of which could explode on you if you ignore them. And so, as in the case of war, sometimes you have to consider whether or not the objective and ideal of a balanced budget doesn't need to yield to a higher priority. And that's going to be a constant question, I think, for administrations, whoever they are, for a number of years. And there's still a third point I'd like to make about the budget. You know, this is the one budget in America which combines operating and capital expenditures into one. And I just wonder how many of our great corporations in America could present balanced budgets if they included in their spending statement the capital investments which they make in a particular year. At one time, I haven't done it in recent years, but at one time, for example, I analyzed our national budget. Found there were, the budget was about $92 or $93 billion. There were $22 billion of capital items. Now, any business, small or large, state and local government, set that aside in a separate budget. On that basis, they're able to claim a balanced budget. Even private citizens, private debt has grown to a greater extent than any other debt, including federal debt, since World War I. And yet, most citizens who are buying homes and cars and television sets on time and credit and not treating that as part of the total spending in any given year, consider they're operating a balanced budget. And I think it's time that we separate capital spending from operating expenditures, balance the operating budget, and on the capital budget, we evaluate that in terms of our needs for capital investments as a nation.
Senator, corporations and private individuals have to pay off their debts. They reduce it from time to time, whereas the national government keeps going up.
Net corporate debt has grown since World War I at a faster rate than the federal debt. Now, we, in the federal budget, we turn over these things just as corporations do. They refinance as soon as their capital needs require it. You don't have corporations with the same outstanding evidences of indebtedness that they had 20 years ago, of course. But their debt turns over and grows. This has been the story in the case of corporations. It's been the story in the case of state government. I was a governor, and I was able to claim a balanced budget because the operating budget was in balance. But the capital expenditures were treated differently, and I'm sure they are here in Florida. I think that the picture with respect to state government and national government is the same. Sure, you pay off individual debts, particular debts incurred for particular purposes, But the net has been a growth of debt in all aspects of American society, and the federal government is the one budget which doesn't distinguish between the two.
Now, Senator Muskie, you've been described alternately in varying news stories as a stand-in, a relatively unknown, a fresh face, a crowd pleaser, a tough-minded liberal. These are all quotes taken from different stories.
How probably all inaccurate. Stevenson once used. He said, you know, I don't really think I was specially delivered by Providence to run for this office. I'm just a small town lawyer who accidentally finds himself in a big town. Take a look at it when it comes. So much will depend upon what happens in Vietnam, obviously. The war is still on, and I would hope and pray and certainly do everything I could and should do what I could to see that it wasn't. It's still on. We've got a different situation than if it isn't. You can't guess on the tax surcharge independent of that problem.
Senator Westy? You spoke of the dissenters, the young people who disrupted crowds. Do you feel that a change, or first of all, do you support a change in the choosing of a president and vice president in the country? And also, do you feel that this would quiet the dissenters in giving them a voice to run for, to participate in national politics and a voice in it?
Well, of course, we can't make those changes before November 5th. With respect to those changes, yes. On the question of nominating presidential candidates, I think that at the very least we ought to liberalize and democratize the state conventions and national convention. I think we ought to consider, in those states that do not do so, the election of delegates to the national convention. In those states where state conventions select delegates to the national convention. The state conventions themselves, I think, ought to be based upon the franchise. I think that to the extent that is possible, both the national and state conventions ought to be based upon the one man, one vote principle. On the question of a national primary, I have some questions about that, although I think it's an objective to be studied seriously. Two questions I have about it that I would want resolved before I came down hard for it would be, one, the question of cost. Presumably, you'd have to consider the possibility of two national primaries in order to narrow the candidates down to one who has a majority support. And the cost now of the general election, of the various state primaries, is almost prohibitive for all candidates except those who have independent resources of their own. If you add two very costly national primaries, you compound the problem. The second problem that I see in the idea of a national primary is what it would do to the two-party system nationally. The only function, really meaningful function, that two national party organizations play is the holding of the national convention and the selection of the president. And if we were to eliminate that function, you might well then really fragmentize the two national parties into 50 state parties. And what that would do to the integrity of the two-party system is purely speculative, but I think there's something we ought to concern ourselves with.
Senator, at this point, I'm supposed to rise because of your tight schedule. You try to wind us up by saying thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much.